How did you get interested and involved in the Aboriginal people's history and heritage?
I was a World War II baby refugee born in June of 1947 in Europe. My father and mother were fleeing Russian occupation of Poland after the war. My father was captured by the Nazis in 1939 and forced to work on railway lines and bridges until the end of World War II. So in 1950, my mother and I, after a terrible ocean voyage in December, arrived in Canada to join my father, who had been working on a farm for many months preparing for us to remain here in this country. And Brantford, Ontario is where that the name of the city. And right next door, as I found out as I was growing up, was a territory called the Grand River Six Nations Territory. Many people know them as the Iroquois. The name itself implies six nations, like Seneca, Mohawk, Onondaga being three of them. They migrated up here after the American Revolution that was over in 1784. That's another story, and they settled along the Grand. Now, they are a grouping of nationalities, just like in Europe, you know, France and Poland and Germany were European. This is a grouping of First Nations that happened to settle here. Found out about the Indians, and that's what they were called back then, through TV and movies. And at that time, Westerns were very popular. Every kid in the neighborhood all over the country played cowboys and Indians, as they called it. For example, the Lone Ranger with his friend Tonto. His native friend Tonto. And Tonto, as it turns out, I found out later, was born on the Grand River Six Nations. So I saw Tonto, whose actual name is Jay Silverheels, close up in 1957 at a parade. And then our museum here in Brantford had many, many old artifacts, some going back as far back as 10,000 years. And I went there often, and with the library close by, I started to read as much about them as I could. Well, there is a residential school in the city of Brantford. The land actually belongs to the Grand River Six Nation. The building's still there. So when I was a boy, when I was here in 1950, it was still in operation. It didn't shut down until 10 or 15 years later. So I was only a few blocks away from that when we lived here in town. I didn't even know of its existence until I got older. And of course, now I've been down there because there's a museum there, and I've been down there many, many, many times. And I wrote an article recently about a survivor from that school. His name is Freddie. I'll be 69 this year, so he'll be 70. So there's 1 year difference. And the story I wrote, of course, is that when I was little, and my mother and I, of course, we were surviving right the aftermath of the war and here in a new country, that we were here volunteering to be assimilated into Canada. And that he was only a few blocks away in this residential school, and he was being forced to assimilate. And I think many people know the rest of the story about the residential schools across the country. So there I was. I mean, as I was growing up, all this stuff was happening all around me. And then it made sense to me as I got older and started to meet people like Freddie or going down there. And I know the friends that are the curators at that particular museum.
Believe it or not, Zig, not that many people know about it outside Canada. So maybe you want to say just a few words about the residential schools.
They were actual locations. There were buildings that were built to accommodate First Nations children across the country, Inuit, Métis. These children were brought in to these locations across the country. They were taken at a young age, 5, 6 years old, and they were taught skills, survival skills, outside of their own culture. Like the boys were taught farming, basically, and the women or the young girls were taught domestic things, and then there's the reading, the writing, and everything else too. So their whole identity physically and what they carried inside, I would say spiritually and everything else too, like their hair was cut, their First Nations clothing was taken away. They weren't allowed to speak their own language. There's a phrase actually going back, I think one of our prime ministers said, to kill the Indian within the child. It's interesting. And of course, when they were older, around 17, 18 years old, and there's much more in between this, of course, they graduated or were sent out, and many of them, when they went back to their own communities, after being away for so long. Because the ones here in this particular school, many of them were from hundreds of miles away, from all over Ontario, or maybe other parts of Canada. So they were away from their families on their own. And they were sent back at that age. And, of course, they didn't know their language, didn't know their culture. They were people of two worlds. They had one foot in the white society, one foot in the native society, and they really didn't belong in either one. And therefore, there's that dilemma of the survivors now. You say the last residential school wasn't that long since it was closed, you know, 20 years or so, or 25, that there's these survivors that are, you know, that struggled. Like, what do we do? And they got involved in all kinds of things that, you know, kind of, whether it be alcohol or what have you, that led to incredible difficulties and a lot of suicide. And, of course, you can hear, I think, people that have heard interviews, and there's lots of these interviews that have been out there recently about the struggles, that they still feel that pain. You know,
the problem was also the abuse. There was both physical, emotional, and sexual abuse.
Yeah. A lot of these schools were run by, you know, various churches or government organizations. And yes, there were abuses. Not everybody, though. I've met people that said that, you know, their parents couldn't take care of them because the First Nations Métis still, I think, in not equal measure suffer from neglect. I mean, there's poverty and this and that that takes place. So some of them say, gee, you know, at least we were fed there, even though they got one egg a week. There were situations, you know, that people now being older have sworn under oath, and there are a lot of accounts of that taking place.
What contacts did you have or have you had with the Aboriginal community, because they have accepted you, your books, everything you do?
That was an evolution, of course, when I was small. I mean, I didn't have any contact that I was aware of. My earliest memory, actually, is when I was about 6 or 7 in the neighborhood I lived in, which was actually a mixed neighborhood. I remember blacks. I remember Europeans, I suppose, or Canadians of sort of several different nationalities, a Dutch family and so on. But there was one little boy that lived on the top of the hill, and his name was Mark. And I rarely saw him, because when everybody else was playing cowboys and Indians, Mark never came out to play. But I do remember that to this very day. And I do remember him saying to me that in some way he was related to Jay Silverheels, because I used to sit in front of his house and we just sort of dug a little hole and played marbles and looked at each other. So, you know, there was that little boy, there was the museum, there was the reading the little books, you know, that I found. And, of course, when I was 10, you know, seeing Jay Silverheels, this international figure, this Tonto character who was a native person. I mean, he was a Hollywood star. All of this, you know, just morphed into later years. You know, the older I got, the more intense, you know, my interest was. The more friends I made, or relationship I created with people from the Grand River Six Nations and other First Nations territories, and to where I am right now. And that was over decades. You know, being 69, so I'd say that's 55 years. At the very least, and perhaps 60, where it's developed. And now I would say that most of my friends are from the Grand River Six Nations territory, like elders, academics, adults, children. Ray Skye, a very famous artist, Don and Ron Montour, their elders, Wendy Hill, Renee Hill, Rick Montour. And but I've always stated that I write about, but not for, and there's a difference. I've always made every effort to make sure that my writing is based on good information. And I write it to help others to understand many things about the First Nations and Métis, in particular the Six Nations, the way I learned it and the way I understand it. And I'm still learning.
But you do have their kind of quote-unquote blessing.
Now, when you say blessing, I suppose, yeah, here's the testament. Over 60 First Nations schools use our guide, 22 universities. There's 2 pages in the back of the guide of many people, both native and non-native, that helped put it together, you know, academics with the lesson plans, you know, for the teachers and so on. The Six Nations Iroquois Program Teachers Resource Guide that Ray Sky and I wrote together. That's the one that's in 695 schools. And my other books, my latest one, Wampum, the story of Shaylin the Clam, where I explain a wampum belt on a young person's level. They actually sell my book on the Six Nations territory, and they use it in the schools. It's the newest one. So there's a trust there that I've developed. I talk to people in the community that I know, and then I put it out that way. So the writing process isn't just writing it bang out it goes. Including the new four books I'm writing, they're a set of four for kind of grade, for kindergarten to grade three, ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, colors and shapes, where it's all the art in there is done by a Métis friend of mine. The art is done from that native perspective, and it's in French and English, this one's going to be.
What is it that fascinates you in this? Like, what have you learned? How you obviously have become a richer individual. It has enriched you, I'm sure. But in what way?
Yeah. I think starting off when I was little, I think every kid, probably every kid because of the television. You know, television when I was a kid when in the 50s, it just started becoming popular. I remember when, you know, there were black and white and then color TV started to happen. And all you saw was warriors, you know, these guys dressed in war paint and running around with bows and arrows and fighting the cavalry and all that kind of stuff. So it was that mystery, like, who are these people? Where do they live? I remember people that used to visit here from different parts, like my mom and dad, they'd want to go down to the Six Nations. They wanted to see the teepees. They wanted to see the, quote-unquote, the Indians. Well, they were expecting to see what they saw on television. They were surprised when they saw homes there, you know, people dressed in clothing of the time, you know, shirts, this and that. They said, where are the Indians? Well, what do you think you were going to see? So people have this fascination. Like in Europe, it's quite a big thing, the Iroquois in particular, because of the history. So I love their history. I love their culture. And now I love their determination to survive. Their respect for Mother Earth, or, you know, all natural things, which we're seeing a lot of now about the environment. Their loyalties, their sense of humor. Their willingness to share with me, for example, and I feel entrusted, and I hold that close to my heart. I do my best not to break that trust and friendship that I developed over decades. But it's all of these things together, and I guess one of the things that people will understand is quite often the every page that you turn, like in the Book of Life or something, the next page is always something interesting to develop and to find. So I've my interest has peaked, and now, of course, people look at me as a source of information. And that little boy, that little Polish boy inside me, when I came to this country not speaking English or getting beat up because of my name and things that happened, like people throwing rocks at our house, whatever, all this stuff. I think now growing up, coming from a place of not seeming to have any value, and this was my own personal hobby, my choice to know. And it wasn't until 7 years ago or so that I started to write. So now I have four books, and I have a guide in close to 700 schools. And people are asking me to speak at schools or asking me to go to various places and talk. And then I think it's funny as I come across these things, like what is the Polish connection to the native people?
Yeah, what is the Polish connection to the native people?
Well, there's actually many. And some when I go back into the settlement by Europeans, in particular of North America, the Poles in different degrees and numbers were here as early as like the middle of the 17th century. There was a community, people coming in. Now everybody hears about the English, the French, the Dutch, the Vikings, and that. But there were these little pockets. I thought that was great. So we, in my ancestry, like not directly, I don't think there was a Mishak there necessarily, settled in this country. During the French and Indian War, there were likely Poles around, because certainly during the American Revolution there were. I think it's Kosciuszko, who I believe was an officer with the American General Washington, and was building bridges and forts. I mean, that's one example. Now take it into the War of 1812, which followed the American Revolution. There was a company of Polish soldiers that actually fought alongside the British against the Americans at Fort Erie in 1814. And there's about 15 or 20 bodies there, buried. I have their names listed in one of my books. Then take it forward a little bit. World War One, J. Silverheels' father, the Tonto, who was known for Tonto, he actually trained Polish men in particular that came in from the United States and in Canada, trained them, and he went over with them to fight against the Germans in World War One. J. Silverheels' brother, one of his brothers, married a Polish woman from Buffalo. When I look at the Polish history, there seems to be a common denominator between Poland's struggle to maintain its sovereignty, its well-being, and its culture. Poland has been faithfully an ally when I look at World War II, for example, and it was abandoned and taken by Russia. Like the First Nations, you know, they want to maintain their sovereignty. They want to sustain their culture. And they were mistreated after being loyal allies, as Poland had been. And I find that common thing there, too, because when I have conversations with new people I meet from the First Nations, and sometimes they say, well, what do you know about our trials and tribulations? I says, more than you think. And then I go back to Poland not being a country for about 150 years and how we've been divided. I said, yes. I said, my ancestors go back thousands of years in Europe. I said, I have a sense. I know what it's like to have a country taken over and people killed, and then our people were spread all over the world, et cetera, et cetera. But when I went to Poland a couple of years ago and I met my two half-sisters and their brother for the very first time, they were sitting there and we were talking Mieszak, or Misha. And I think Misha in Polish means like little bear. I thought, well, that's close enough to Mieszak. So I bought at a church there, a beautiful wooden church, I bought a wooden carved bear, a brown bear. And so when I brought that back, and I actually took it down to the Six Nations, because they too are saying, you know, like, we really, my friends say, we are so pleased that what you do for our people, you know, that what you've been doing for our people. And then I said, look at this bear. And I said, I knew I must have native blood, or I know I must have, because look at, here's a little bear. And Misha means, you know, kind of bear kind of thing. And there's a bear clan in the Six Nations culture. I'll continue to do what I'm doing for the rest of my life. I found a purpose, I suppose, too, to be selfish, that I have found a purpose. And I'm being helpful to people. I have native people I've never met before in my life when I'm at book signing and so on that will stand there. They'll come up and engage in conversation and then reach out their hand and say thank you. You know, I it draws tears to my eyes, because, you know, to be able to do something like that, I really mean that. And the little kids, the little native kids you know, I go down there and sometimes I speak at the schools and they're sitting there and I'm telling them about, you know, what I know about their history and culture, and these little brown eyes looking at me and smiling, you know. Honest to goodness, I have a mission bridging. People know me here in Brantford for bridging between the Six Nations in particular and the community of Brantford, Brant County. But I look at it in the bigger picture. It's bridging between First Nation, Métis and Inuit, and Canadians. And at the same time, and you talk about this little boy, this little Ziggy boss inside me that my mother used to call me, this little Mieszak inside, is also bridging between being a DP, a deported person, an immigrant, and what my parents went through, and bridging between people. I'm showing people and helping make them understand what Polish people are about also. That's why I'm a huge fan about supporting Polish war veterans, and I helped out here in Brantford with the Polish War Memorial 3 years ago. First one ever done here. And that's that bridging, you know, where the veterans, and I've met with a veteran again this weekend, 93 years old, Paul Loiko. He fought at Monte Cassino for we fought for your freedom and ours. And that will stick in my memory, I mean, until I die. And my children know that. And I speak about that not in anger, but I tell people, I said, my ethnic background is Polish. And as a little boy, I got abused because I was an immigrant. That's why these refugees now, I can understand something of what's going on. And so that is my thing. My it's the bridging. It's my thank you to Canada for taking my family in and a lot of other Polish refugees from that time period, if I'm going to isolate it to that time. And I will do that gratitude and thank you forever. And I said thank you publicly at the Rotary. I said on my parents' behalf, my children's behalf, my behalf. I said I want to thank you and for all the other Polish people that this country took in. I said that's a little bit of what I can do. My ethnicity, I wish I was as comfortable with feeling as good as I do now about my Polish ethnicity. Yeah, my dad was a blacksmith, and they were laborers. My father was a factory. My mother worked in the summertime out in the fields. When my mother and my father publicly, when they used to speak Polish when I was little, I would almost run away. I was ashamed. It's like, oh my God, you know. And Zygmunt, my mother would yell, Zygmunt. Well, I hated it. That's why Zyg is okay. But now, call me Zygmunt. Call me Zygmunt Marian Miszak. To jest moje nazwisko.